Hey everyone, it's Peter Hodson here, thanking you for tuning in to the I Heart Guitar podcast. And you guys, I could not be more thrilled with the response to last week's first episode. I'm just really honored that you would listen to this stuff, and just the response has been insane, so thank you so much. I've started a Patreon page if you'd like to kick in a few bucks to help support the podcast, and that will also get you access to a separate subscriber feed that will have all kinds of cool stuff. There will be jams and gear demos and longer interviews, call-in shows, my reactions to albums, all kinds of cool stuff. So if you head to Patreon, you can find that. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes, and let's get into the episode. So we've got four interviews today. The first is a little mini chat with St. Vincent from NAMM this year. It's only about 3 or 4 minutes long. It's all the time we could kind of grab amongst the NAMM craziness. Then we've got Richie Kotzen in an interview that was done before his recent Australian tour. Then we've got Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys, whose new record Waiting on a Song is out now. And then we've got Walter Trout, the blues legend, whose new album is called We're In This Together, and it's a great record. It's packed with heaps of special guests. So let's get into it. Here is St. Vincent, whose new record Mass Seduction is out now. We did this interview at the NAMM booth for Ernie Ball Music Man, and so it's pretty loud. You know, standard disclaimer applies. Some of these interviews weren't recorded with podcasts in mind, so they can be a little bit rough sounding. But yeah, so we were just kind of tucked in a corner there talking guitar, and it was really cool to meet St. Vincent. You know, she's an incredible artist and a super nice person. So here's that chat now.
How did you come up with the visuals for this guitar? It's not shaped like a normal guitar, you know?
Yeah, well, I've been playing the Albert Lee, yeah. Ernie Ball Albert Lee, for a tour. The first tour I really played on was this David Byrne tour I did called Loveless Giant. And it was such a versatile guitar, and I loved the neck. I fell in love with the neck. So, I knew that the coming into designing a guitar with Ernie Ball, I would want to have that rosewood neck.
Yeah.
And based on a lot of factors, like one, I'm a fairly small person, so I can't play heavy guitars, so it's, throws your back up. So I wanted it to be super light, and I wanted it to be super tone flexible, and I wanted it to have an amazing whammy bar.
Yeah.
And so I kind of sketched out something. I also knew I like angularity in design, and I like the Memphis design of the 80s and all that stuff, so I wanted something that looked kind of retro but also futuristic. So I drew a little sketch the first time I met them, and then we just refined and refined and refined it to make it as light as possible.
So in terms of the sound, like, you have such a distinctive sound, and you know, people kind of get used to expecting a certain sound to come out of a certain guitar,
yeah.
But from what I've heard of that thing, it can do everything.
Yeah, it really can.
Yeah. So tell me about the color choices. I love the new line, you know, this year. For me, like, the flat black thing never works.
Yeah.
And on this shape, it's so, you know, unique that it really does. You know?
I love the stealth black.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
It might be my favorite of the new line.
Yeah.
Because it's, it makes you want to play it differently.
Yeah.
It makes you want to abuse it and turn it, you know, tune it really low.
Yeah. You know, like, I have synesthesia, and so for me, like, I play vastly differently on different guitars.
Yeah.
And I'm really curious to see what happens when I pick up different models, you know, the same model but different finishes.
Yeah.
It always comes out different, you know?
Yeah, you'll pick up the Heritage one and play AC/DC.
Cool. So, I guess you've been testing these on the road for a while now?
I've been testing them in the studio quite a bit, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. What are you working on? What's it shaping up like?
A new record, yeah. It should come out later this year.
Yeah, any hints as to what we can expect, or...?
No.
Do you know, or is it shaping itself up?
It's shaping up.
Yeah. It's so exciting. So can we expect to see you in Australia anytime soon again? Or?
Yeah, I'm sure. Late this year or next year.
Cool.
For sure.
Now, I love your guitar style and how, like, again, I think angular is a great word to describe it. It reminds me of, like, maybe Adrian Belew or something like that.
Oh, I love Adrian Belew. Yeah.
How did that come together? You play like no one else.
Now, Richie Kotzen has always been one of my favorite players. He just has that kind of combination of bluesy slinkiness and crazy technique, and he can sing his ass off. And his new record is called Salting Earth, and it's kind of a nice culmination of a lot of the different styles he's done over the years. We did this interview right before his recent Australian tour. I've chopped out the parts about the tour just so it doesn't get confusing, since the tour's already happened. But this was a really good chat. Richie was also on my buddy Dean Del Rey's podcast, I think a couple of years ago now, and it was a really great, super long interview. So if this 15 minutes or so, you know, makes you want to hear more, go check out Dean's podcast, Let There Be Talk, and you'll hear a great, really extended Richie Kotzen interview. As someone who's been getting your records since, 1990-something, early 90s, I can say that, man, you've... Yeah, wow. Well, I mean, you've done so many different things. You know, I look at my CD collection and it's like, you know, it's almost like a cross-section of everything in my CD collection. There's, you know, soul kind of stuff. There's, you know, heavier things. There's more blues rock kind of stuff. In fact, one thing I really dig about the new record is that you kind of think it's going one way and then you kind of bring out the, like, Wilson Hawk kind of style a little bit, you know?
Sure. Well, you know, I grew up listening to, I grew up outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and when I was a kid, you know, there was a huge soul R&B thing happening there. I was exposed to that. But then at the same time, you know, you had what we call now classic rock, you know, bands like Bad Company and Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix and that sort of thing. So my pendulum kind of swings between those influences from when I was a little kid. And then as I started learning the guitar, the guitar intrigued me in a way, you know, really from more of the rock side of things, just the power that it had. But then after a while, I started exploring more of jazz music stuff. I got into George Benson or Alan Holdsworth. So, you know, my influences are kind of varied in that way. And I guess, you know, better or for worse, it's reflected in the music I write. So that's kind of why you have that kind of, you know, broad palette of what you're talking about, where, you know, you have the, what you mentioned, the Wilson Hawk record, which was much more of a soul-driven kind of thing, it kind of pay homage to those roots. But then at the same time, you know, you've got stuff like what I do with the Whiny Dog, which is much, much heavier. So that's kind of, you know, the area that I live in, so to speak.
Cool. One thing I really wanted to ask you about the new record too is, it's a bit of a guitar nerd question, but there's a super clean sound on End of Earth. Is that just marking up an unplugged electric guitar? I think it kind of kicks in halfway through End of Earth. It's like a rhythm guitar part that's like super clean, and it sounds to me like it's just putting a mic up to a guitar that's not plugged in or something.
Well, I know there's an acoustic guitar in that song.
Okay.
Maybe you're hearing that. But, you know, I do record direct sometimes for that sound. I mean, I've done that many times, actually. Just plugged right into a preamp and recorded direct. But, you know, it all depends on what I'm looking to do with the actual song, what kind of mood I'm trying to convey. You know, sometimes an amp is the answer, sometimes plugging in direct is the answer.
Yeah. How would you say playing without a pick has changed your style? I know, I think when I last interviewed you, you'd kind of more recently just started doing that, but now it's been, you know, a number of years.
Well, the reality is, you know, I would always kind of, you know, have a song or two on a record where I did more of the finger style approach.
Mm.
But what makes it more noteworthy is I never attempted to do an entire show without using the guitar pick. And that happened about 10 years ago, probably. I was on tour in Latin America, and I think I was in Brazil. I was very frustrated with how I was playing, and I thought to myself, I gotta change something. I'm gonna try something new tomorrow night. And I tried to get Inez without a pick.
Hmm.
And so it was interesting what happened. Immediately I lost half my vocabulary.
Huh.
No alternate picking, lip picking. Anything that I did that was a fast run was strictly a legato approach. But it opened up other doors for me, and I kind of stuck with it, and I went back and tried to relearn how to do the alternate picking approach, and I kind of picked up a few flamenco techniques from one of my friends. The sweep picking thing, I had to kind of relearn how to do that and figure that out. But the real value was it opened up so many other doors for me, other things that I can play that I simply couldn't play with a guitar pick. So it was a good move for me in the sense of kind of refreshing my relationship with the instrument.
Mm. I think also it takes away that one little synthetic element and, you know, gets you closer to just, you know, the link between your heart and the string. You know, you don't have this little piece of plastic that you've got to, you know, have as a middleman.
I agree. And then the real thing, the most important thing, is one less thing I got to pack in my suitcase. I don't have to take guitar picks.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, you probably got fans who are like, throw me a pick. And you're like, I can't. I'll throw you a fingernail. what guitars are you favoring at the moment? I seem to see you with a lot more Telecasters than, you know, a few years ago. I think I'm gonna be honestly geeky and say I got a Strat because of I was going through a big phase of like the Motherhead album, and I got the live DVD, and you're playing a Strat through that, and I was like, hey, it's time I got a Strat. But I see you with a lot more Tellies again lately.
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened. In the very, very early stages of my career, I had a bunch of different guitars. I had a Yamaha SG that was my main guitar. I had a Kramer. I had an Ibanez guitar. And at some point, I went out to the music store, and I bought, the same day, I bought a Telecaster and a Strat.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really wanted the tonality of those instruments. And the one thing I love about the Telecaster, it's really like a blank canvas. I mean, you can do so much on that guitar. And so I, throughout my career, since probably 1990, I kind of went back and forth. I went through a Strat phase, a Tele phase, and I ended up having two signature models with Fender. There's a Strat and a Telecaster, and those are the ones that I play to this day. On this last tour, I was playing the Telecaster for most of the set. I have the Strat with me for certain things, so I kind of bounce, you know, between the two.
Yeah, cool. Do you still have... I remember back in the day you were doing ads for those Starfield guitars that Ibanez were doing. Do you still have those?
I have a few of them. I gave a couple to my friend Mike Barney years ago,
mm-hmm.
and but I do have a few of them. I don't play them anymore. They're unfortunately sitting in their cases. I have one on a stand in my house just because it's just such a pretty guitar.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting. That is what led me to the Fender endorsement. I was making a record back in 1991, and the bass player had a Fender deal, and they came down to deliver a new bass to him. And they saw the Starfields, and they said, "Ah, no, we're not going to have that. We're going to give you two real guitars." They gave me two built guitars. One was a Tele, one was a Strat. And the brown Tele became instantly my main guitar. The red one is the guitar that you've seen me play on the Motherheads record. And that's what led to the signature models.
Yeah, cool. Let's see. I've got a whole bunch of geeky questions here, and I just don't want to overly nerd it out. So a lot of our readers... a lot of our readers are, you know, home recordists and stuff. I was wondering if you could tell me about your studio, what kind of a setup you have, what kind of a vibe it is.
Sure. Well, you know, it really comes down to the gear that I have. Many years ago, from working in major studios, I would really pay attention to what the engineer was really, using, the go-to pieces. And so I started buying some of those things over the years. So I've got the Neve 1073s, a real set. I've got the API stuff. I've got some Telefunken stuff. I've got some Manly gear, some Focusrite things, the Blue Range that they came out with a long time ago. And more recently, there's a company called Overstand, and the fellow that builds their gear, I just moved about 6 months ago, but up until then, my next-door neighbor was the guy who has this company, Overstand, and they make amazing microamps. I would suggest anyone to go online and check out this stuff. Great stuff for major studios, home studios, what have you. And reasonably priced.
Yeah, cool. I imagine being such a multi-instrumentalist, you must have everything set up so that you can, do anything at a moment's notice instead of having to, plug this in and that in before you can lay down an idea.
Well, that's the key. Yeah, I've actually said that before. That's the whole key that allows me to do what I do the way I do it. So once I get my drum tone, that doesn't change. That signal path stays up, I just moved, so I don't have a studio right now, but when I did have a studio, everything was up all the time, so if I wanted to at any point jump behind the drums and change a fill or something or what have you, I had the option to do that, so that's really what makes it possible to, and the real point is that you want to, when you have an idea, you want to be able to act on it. You don't want to have to fiddle around trying to figure out, a signal flow to get a tone. If that stuff's all ready to go, then you can jump in and do what you got to do.
Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, I actually bought a new interface because I was using an old Pro Tools M-Box that was like 12 years old. And I got something that didn't have necessarily the best converters and stuff, but it had the easiest way of plugging everything in at once, so I can just pick up whatever, because I find, for me, my creative flow just falls apart if suddenly I'm tangled in chords and stuff.
Oh, yeah, I remember years ago when I would make my records and I'd be in the studio with an engineer and they're messing around with the guitar tone for a snare drum sound or whatever it was. By the time they got it figured out, I didn't feel like playing.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to ask you about what wah-wah pedal you're using, because there's a really cool sound on the record, and I'm like, that doesn't sound like my wah-wah.
Well, I've got this little pedal from Brazil called a Fire Wah, and it's smaller than a normal crybaby. And somebody gave it to me, and I just started using it, and, this became part of my rig. I like the way it sounds, and I never did an AB test, so I don't really know the comparison. On my piano, I'm using one of my Vintage Vibe electric piano. I'm using the Crybaby Wah. And I did AB that, and the Crybaby seems to work better for the electric piano, but the one that I'm using on the guitar is little Brazilian pedal called the Fire Wah. It's kind of a young company, and I actually went online because I was curious about it. It's pretty expensive, a lot of money for a wah pedal, but it's very good.
Yeah.
It sounds great, and what I'm using.
Cool. Let's see. Oh, the last thing I should ask about is your Tech 21 fly rig. I know so many players who have bought that thing, from all different genres. It just seems to have filled a niche for a lot of players that nothing else was quite doing.
Well, you know, it's interesting, the evolution of that pedal. Now, I've been friends with Andy Barta from Tech 21 for a very long time. We've been friends. And he came to my house after an AM show, and I had showed him something that I built. You know, I like to tinker around with a soldering iron sometimes. And I took a long, about a foot long, 2x2 electrical box, and I dissected one of my overdrives and one of his delay pedals, and I jammed it in this little box, and I added a foot switch control for my reverb and tremolo on my amp. So I had this little box with with 6 buttons on it, and that was my rig. And I told Anders, look what I made. I said, this is something I made because I do a lot of fly dates where I got to fly in, and I don't want to have a pedal board. So I made one little box that I could throw on the floor and get everything I need. And so he said, let me fix that for you. And he went to work, and that's how he came up with the fly rig. And it's been great. I mean, I've been using that ever since we developed it.
Next up, we've got Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys talking about his new solo record, Waiting on a Song. This interview was recorded, again, to be transcribed for a print article, so the sound quality is not great, but and there's a little bit of a lag on the phone line. But, you know, another reason to contribute to the Patreon, right? The more supporters I have, the better gear I can get, so... So I'm not just dealing with bad phone recordings. But here we go. Here's Dan Auerbach. So I've been listening to the new record, and man, I almost don't know where to start. But the thing that really jumps out to me most is that it feels really joyful. It sounds like a happy album to listen to. It must have been a happy album to make as well. Yeah.
It was just for the love. And also, it was just for the love reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's really great that, I mean, it's a solo album, but it's very selfless because you've got so many, you know, great guests and stuff. It sounds to me like a very live record. I imagine that most of this was recorded, you know, as it went down rather than, you know, overdubbed or anything. So it really feels very interactive and human.
Yeah, well, it was 100%.
Yeah,
it was, and that's why it just, I don't know, I think it was just a lot of stars that were aligning. You know, people came into my life at a certain time. It was when it was all kind of meant to be. Mm. You know, I didn't know some of these people a year ago. I couldn't even have made this record a year ago. You know, it's just. It was all a big learning experience this whole past year.
Yeah. Tell me about your studio. A lot of our readers, you know, are big studio geeks as well as guitar geeks, and I'm sure they'd love to hear about it.
Well, what about it?
I don't know. What's the vibe like there? You know, what kind of gear do you use?
What's the vibe like in the studio?
Yeah.
Well, the vibe is... It is based, and perfectly I built it kind of based after studios that made records that I really loved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, places that weren't too big, but weren't too small, you know, that weren't intimidating, but kind of felt cozy, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's got all kind of early 60s American gear,
yeah,
or late 60s American gear, which is just, I really like that time period. I thought it was good for sound.
Yeah.
So it's like a combination of all that and then all the instruments that I've collected over the years.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Tell me about... Okay, for me, literally the reason I started playing guitar was hearing Mark Knopfler when I was 6 years old and being like, that doesn't sound like any other guitar player I've heard in my six-year-old little life. I've got to do that. What the hell was it like working with that guy?
Well, that was the wild card in the whole project, because that was the only thing that was done remotely.
Yeah.
We cut this song called Shine On Me, and I was listening to playback, and I just heard, I could swear I heard his voice.
Yeah.
In the song. So I got in touch with my manager, and I said, can you send this song, can you find Mark Knopfler's email and send him this song and ask him nicely if he'd want to contribute?
Mm.
And then 2 days later, he sent the song back with the guitar on. Mm-hmm. It was like as easy as that.
Yeah. I mean, he's so identifiable, and, you know, there are plenty of great guitar players out there, but there's only one Mark Knopfler.
Yeah, well, you know what? It was just meant to be. Mm-hmm. You know, the song was made, and he needed to be a part of it. That's just all there was to it, I guess.
Yeah. Let's see. Jerry Douglas. I swear, almost every interview I've done recently, someone's mentioned Jerry Douglas. So, tell me about working with him.
Jerry, he's a freak of nature.
Mm.
I don't know, man. He was here for a few days in the studio, and we had him play out some songs, and he just fit right in, you know? Just like all these other guys, he's just so, it just all comes naturally to him. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Just flows right in there. He's not kind of stuck in some sort of tradition. Not like he can just play traditional music, you know? He's so creative with all those
guys. Yeah. So, in terms of the songwriting, you know, what did you present to these guys? You know, were they completed songs, or did you kind of give them space for their input, you know, in the actual song construction phase?
They were all completed.
Yeah.
They were all completed songs. But then we came up with the arrangement.
Yeah. Cool. Is there any kind of overall theme that you kind of feel this album embodies? You know, either a literal one or a kind of, you know, more abstract?
I think that the theme is a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I think that it's all kind of connected in some way. You know what I mean? Two lines might be fiction, but the next one, you know, are not. I think it kind of goes like that.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about guitars and stuff. did you have a main, you know, workhorse instrument for this record, or did you use a whole bunch of different stuff since you had, I guess, your whole collection there? Actually got a Carvin on the way in a couple of weeks, but it's a very different guitar to that. It's like a headless 7-string.
Oh. Well,
yeah, it's going to be pretty nuts. It's my travel guitar because it fits in the overhead. So what about pedals? Are you much of a, you know, pedal guy on this record?
No.
No?
I don't think I even used one pedal.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Amps. What are you using for amps at the moment?
I basically use all my guitar amps like pedals.
Yeah.
You know, I've got different amps that do different sounds. I just plug into whichever one I want for the song.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Or for the part.
Yeah. Do you have any really interesting obscure amps? I did this article for Premier Guitar a little while ago that was like vintage Australian amps. Back when, for instance, you know, we couldn't get Fender or Vox amps here, and so the local stores would basically make their own version.
Apollo?
Yeah.
Do you have Apollo?
I don't think we have it here, but yeah.
Let me
check. Hang on, it was a while ago that I did the article. But yeah, we had this whole history of weird little amps that, because we didn't have all the parts, we would kind of make our own versions, but they were different enough to be kind of bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah. So what are some of the more, unusual amps you have?
I've got some old Magnetones and just some Fenders and stuff. Nothing crazy, really.
Yeah.
Just tiny amps. I like all the smaller amps, the old team amps. Stuff with not a lot of bullshit in the circuit, not a lot of switches. Just kind of simple amps, but I like them to have reverb on.
Yeah.
I like onboard reverb. I think it sounds better.
Yeah. Well, there's some great kind of splashy reverb on Shine On Me that really stood out to me there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all from the amp.
Yeah. Cool. So do you, in terms of, no one's ever finished with a guitar collection. We're always adding to it. Is there anything you've kind of got your eye on at the moment?
Is there anything I've got my eye on? No.
No?
Nothing. Yeah. I pretty much have everything I've ever wanted.
Yeah.
In the studio. I honestly I need less things in the studio. So
yeah.
I'm thinking I'm eyeballing shit in my studio that needs to go.
Oh yeah.
I'm not keeping my eyeballs on stuff I need generally.
Yeah. I'm kind of doing that because my dad.
If you got anything cool, send me pictures because I'm always looking.
Yeah, I'm kind of doing that because my day job is I'm actually artist relations manager for Seymour Duncan Pickups, and so I'm moving over to California, as soon as the visas go through.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah, so I'm kind of looking at all my stuff and thinking, well, I can't take that. I can't take that. Got to rebuild the collection. Yeah. Do you use any Seymour Duncan stuff?
What?
Do you use any Seymour Duncan stuff?
Oh, do I use any Seymour Duncan stuff?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
If you ever want to, just...
I don't know if I do or not.
Yeah, if you ever want to, just let me know. I can hook you up.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
So, in terms of touring this record, what are you going to do?
I don't have any plans right now to tour.
Yeah.
We're playing a show in Brooklyn next week, actually, but that's the only thing we have scheduled.
Yeah.
But I'm taking the band. I'm taking all the old dudes, all the dudes from the record.
Yeah. Dwayne Eddy.
We're gonna head out.
Does that include Dwayne Eddy?
No, Dwayne's not gonna be there.
He's the only one.
Yeah.
Man, he's a legend. Again, talk about players with identifiable styles.
I know, it's really crazy because Dwayne Eddy and Mark Knopfler are two of the guys who have almost the most identifiable sound.
Yeah.
And they're both on the record. It is really weird.
Yeah.
But I love it. I love that. It's just so crazy.
Yeah. So, a question I like to ask, because every time the answer is different, is what does the guitar mean to you?
What does the guitar mean to me?
Uh-huh.
Well, for me it means a lot, maybe more than most people, because it pays all my bills and it helps me express myself, be able to do this thing that I love, it's the tool that I use to speak with.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how to make music any other way, so it's pretty important.
Yeah. What was the moment where you kind of decided you were going to be a musician?
It was probably when I was really young, watching my family play guitars.
Mm.
I wanted to be able to play and sing with them. I just loved the way the music made me feel, and I loved, I love listening to it.
Yeah. Cool. Did you have any, you know, kind of guitar heroes or anything early on?
Yeah, my uncle. I really loved the way he played guitar. And then as I got older, you know, more people that I listened to and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's so important to have those, like, actual accessible people to look up to. You know, I had all my guitar heroes when I was a kid, but some of them were, like, literally, you know, my guitar teacher, or, you know, there was an older kid at my school who was, like, you know, it's so important to have that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a guy who taught me a few lessons, but mostly I just got to hang out and watch him play.
Yeah.
And his name's Mike Lenz. He still plays in Akron. He's an awesome guitar player.
Yeah.
Really nice guy. Cool. And, you know, there was a guy named Glenn Schwartz. He was in Cleveland. And he was the original guitar player in the James Gang.
Yeah.
Before Joe Walsh joined. And, you know, he kind of taught Joe Walsh how to play. And he played every Thursday in Cleveland. I used to go see him play ever since I was like 17.
Yeah.
And he had a really big influence on me too.
So Walter Trout's new record is called We're All In This Together, and it's loaded with so many great guests. Kenny Wayne Shepherd, Sonny Landreth, Charlie Musselwhite, Robin Ford, Warren Haynes, Eric Gales, Edgar Winter, John Mayall, Joe Bonamassa. It's pretty much like a who's who of, you know, current blues and blues rock guitar. And Walter, of course, is a legend in his own right. So it was really cool to get to talk to him, and I hope you enjoy this chat.
So I've been listening to the new record, and I love it. And I think it speaks a lot about the respect that you have in the industry, that you've got so many, you know, friends coming in to lend a hand.
Yeah, it was actually kind of quite moving to me, the response I got when I was talking to people, you know. I mean, it kind of transpired. I didn't almost set out with this in mind, but, you know, I did I went and had dinner in L.A. with Warren Haynes and Robin Ford, and I just said, hey, man, I'd like to record something with you, Warren. And he's like, well, yeah, remember we did The Sky Is Crying at the New Orleans Jazz Fest together. You know, we did that. I'm like, yeah, that'd be cool. Robin, you want to record something? He's like, yeah, man, let's record. I'm like, well, that's cool. I got those guys. And then I went and played Carnegie Hall with Kenny Wayne Shepherd and Edgar Winter. And we were sitting around in the dressing room, and I kind of brought it up. And a couple weeks later, I played in Toronto with Sonny Landreth at the Jeff Healey Memorial Concert. I was talking to Sonny. I mean, it all just kind of fell into place. It was pretty amazing, really.
Yeah. You know, what it makes me think about is the fact that the blues is such a communal thing. Like, I know for me, when I was about 20 years old, I started going to these blues jam nights, and I realized immediately that it's something that you share with each other, and you kind of pass down like an oral tradition or something. You know, it works best when you share it with other people.
Yeah. You know, the blues is a pretty tight-knit community, and it's not just the musicians, it's the fans also. And I found that out when I got ill, and because of the American healthcare system, we had to ask for financial help. And my wife went on Facebook and just put on there, you know, Walter needs a transplant, we need financial help, and they just, the response was overwhelming. And then there were musicians all over the world getting together and doing benefits for me. There was a benefit in London at Shepherd's Bush Empire, and 45 great musicians turned out that night, 45 of them, you know.
Yeah.
It is a community, and it's a beautiful thing, man. I love being a part of it, you know.
Uh-huh. Let's talk guitar. What are you using at the moment? Do you did you use different guitars on different tracks on this record, or?
I use the same guitar all the time. I'm sort of a one guitar man. I like to establish sort of a relationship with an instrument and get to know every little sort of nuance of that instrument. I like to know what every string on every fret, what kind of sound I'm going to get out of it, and where I'm going to, where it's going to be easier to get harmonics, and where it's going to be easier to bend. And so, you know, I have a guitar that I've been using on the road for a while. The old Strat that I have, that one that's been on the cover of a lot of my records, it's on the cover of this one, too. I bought it in 73, and it was blazing white. Now it's dark, almost dark brown, and half the finish is worn off.
Yeah.
But I retired that from the road some years ago because it was too stressful. And if I were to give you an example, if we had a night off and we're sitting in a hotel and we decide, hey, let's go to the movies, I would take the thing to the movies with me. You know, I wouldn't leave it in the hotel. And if we stopped on the road for lunch, I'd take it into the restaurant. And it was so really stressful that if somebody stole that thing, it's like one of my children, you know.
Yeah.
It's been with me through addictions and through alcoholism and through divorce and through homelessness. And it's been with me through so much. And I even wrote a song about that guitar. It's called Song for My Guitar. And I was sitting looking at it one night thinking what has happened in my life since I bought that thing and how many hours I have on that thing. And I just broke down and wrote this song with tears coming down my face. And it's called Song for My Guitar. But to get to what I'm using now, I retired that guitar because of the kind of the stress. I just wanted to lock it up, to be honest, to give it to my kids when I croak, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a guitar builder in San Diego, and he built a body for me, and he built it to be very light because... you know, that old one is incredibly heavy. It's heavier than a Les Paul for some
reason.
Wow. And, you know, I was really having problems with my left arm for a while, going numb and losing the feeling in my fingers. So he built this body, and I took the neck off of another Strat that I had laying around. I liked the neck. And then Seymour Duncan, who's a friend of mine, called me and said, I hear you're going to retire your old Strat. And I went, yeah, I am. And he said, well, I know your sound. I'll build you some pickups that'll sound, you know, just like it. And he built these pickups and sent them to me, and I put them on this thing probably 8 years ago. And if you do an A-B, if I set up my stage rig in the garage, and I go back and forth from one guitar to the other, it's very hard to tell difference in sound.
Well,
the older one, I would say, the older one maybe is a touch warmer on the neck pickup, but it's the newer one has more balls on the bridge pickup.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, it's a good guitar, man, and it's what I use on the road, and I used that thing on every cut on this record.
So what are you using in terms of amplifiers?
You know, I have been endorsed by Mesa Boogie for probably 35 years. I've been with them. And I used my stage rig, which is a Mark V with a 4x12 open back boogie cabinet with a black metal grill. It's a speaker cabinet that they haven't made for years. And I, I love that combination. And when they told me they were going to stop making those cabinets, so I purchased every one I could find. I've got about six of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love that cabinet. And every time I talk to them, I go by their factory and I hang out. I say, when are you guys going to start making those cabinets again? And they always tell me, never, which is kind of sad.
Yeah. But
I love that company. They have been awesome to me. And as far as I'm concerned, the Boogie Mark V is about the most versatile amp I know, and I use no pedals. I go directly into the amp. And talking guitar, I can tell you I only use one channel also. I use channel 3. I have the gain all the way up. I've got the treble set on about, if you're looking at a clock, it would be set at 3 o'clock. I got the mid-range and the bass set on about 9 o'clock. I'm also not using the graphic EQ, I'm just using the dials. I have it set on extreme. So it's basically, if you look at suggested settings that Boogie puts out, I can hit you here. I have it set for death metal, you know, which you won't find another, in quotes, blues man who will say that to you. I can control the cleanliness just by the volume button on the guitar.
Mm.
If I play with the guitar on 2 or 3, it's very clean, it's very beefy. And between 3 on the guitar and 10 on the guitar, it just adds more sustain, it adds more balls. And by the time you get to 10 on the guitar, you can hold a note for 45 minutes if you want.
Yeah. That's kind of a lost art. There aren't many players out there who kind of ride the volume control like that and do everything from one spot, but I prefer to do that because it minimizes the amount of stuff that can go wrong. You know, you can find yourself on the wrong side of the stage to your overdrive pedal and, you know, what are you going to do?
That's exactly right. I can tell you, you know, I'm an old guy. I came up through the ranks playing in bars for years. And back in the 60s, when you were playing in bars, they didn't mic amplifiers. The PA was only for the vocals. So the way I learned to play was you have to have your amp loud enough that when you're playing a solo, you're up over the band, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're playing rhythm behind the vocal, you have to turn the guitar down. And but you have to have the amp set loud enough that it's going to fill the room when you play a solo.
Yeah.
And I prefer to still do that. You know, I'm working the volume button all the time. And, you know, that's just the way I do it. And it's funny, a lot of times I'll invite some young guitar player to come up and sit in with my band, and they come out and they hook up a pedal board and something fucks up and they're not getting any sound and they're down there fucking around with their pedals. And I say, look, man, the show's got to move along here. You either got to make your pedals work or why don't you just turn around and plug into your amplifier and play?
Yeah.
You know? And so I've seen that happen on numerous occasions, exactly what you're talking about, where something fucks up with these pedals and they don't know what it is and they're down there screwing around and the audience is sitting there waiting. And so I just don't use pedals.
Yeah. One of the best things I ever did for my playing is, you know, I'm into metal and all that stuff, but I'm also into blues. So for a solid year, I left my Ibanez in its case and I took my Telecaster with me to college, no distortion pedals and no pick. And I was like, this is going to be the year where I learn to do this. And then I went back to my pointy guitars and my metal and stuff.
Yeah, that's great, man.
Yeah.
You know, that's awesome.
Well,
I can tell you that lately I've been, you know, I've done a few shows. I'm in this band, the Supersonic Blues Machine, with Billy Gibbons and Lance Lopez and Lyne Haynes and Wappenford is one of the guests. And We did a couple of shows with Steve Lucas.
Oh, I love that guy.
He's a friend of mine. He has a kind of a Strat, a custom Strat looking thing, but it has humbuckers on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the sound he was getting. So right now I am having a Strat made with just two humbuckers, and I'm going to be trying that out in the near future.
Yeah.
See how it works for me. Because I've been playing Strats since like 1970, you know.
Okay, that's it for this week. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. It means a hell of a lot to me that you're supporting this podcast. And, you know, if you want to kick in some bucks on the Patreon page, go for it. And I will catch you next week with Dweezil Zappa, Matt Heafy from Trivium, and the band 10 Years.